Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Thomas Ariti. Coming up this Thursday, we'll hear about new research which could eliminate the need for chemotherapy for some leukemia patients. And President Trump says he's not in a trade war with China, but you'll hear from one expert who warns that might not be the case.
A trade war is when you throw a punch and someone throws a punch back. That's exactly what we've seen happening. Look, don't get me wrong, I think China will be keen to negotiate with Trump, and I don't think Trump really wants a trade war either, but you've thrown the first punch. So that's a definition of how a trade war starts.
But first, in a blow to Australia's medal chances in the Commonwealth Games, champion hurdler Sally Pearson has announced to the media that she's pulling out. She's been suffering from an Achilles injury. Here's some of what she's had to say at this afternoon's press conference on the Gold Coast.
Obviously, I'm here to announce that I am pulling out of the Australian Commonwealth Games athletics team in the 100-metre hurdles and the 4x1-metre relay. Due to an Achilles issue that has been around for quite some time now but has flared up considerably in the last few days. And, yeah, that's my decision, and obviously very disappointed, but I'm very happy to be here to support the Australian athletics team and the Australian team as well. So I guess that's the announcement.
Sally, I don't mean to be rude, but why are we finding out about this now? It seems perhaps a little disingenuous. When did you know that you wouldn't be able to run?
2 days ago. I was at a training session and I went there with full confidence. If you were here last week in Brisbane, I did race at the competition, which was very obvious that I was still in very good shape and still racing very fast. And I went to training as planned after that competition. Trained quite well in Brisbane at the camp up there, very confident still. And then a few days after that, I did another, came out here, I think, at the village, and did another training session, full confidence warming up. And then went into some hurdle drills and then went into some run-throughs and just couldn't do it. The thing with tendons is that they spike very quickly, and this has been an ongoing issue for a couple of years now, and it's just unfortunate that the timing was now, and my health comes first. I wanted to be able to go into the opening ceremony and enjoy myself. I had a big role to play, and that's why I left it till today to announce it. From a few days ago at training.
Champion hurdler Sally Pearson speaking there on the Gold Coast. And in that media conference, she's told journalists this does not mean the end of her career and she intends to make a comeback. Well, ABC reporter Neil Cross is covering the Commonwealth Games on the Gold Coast. I spoke to him just before Sally Pearson made her announcement. Was this an expected decision to be made by Sally Pearson?
In the last month, I think she has released the information that she's had a little bit of Achilles soreness. It seems like through her training, and she's had some competitions in the past month or so leading into the Games, it seems that that has flared rather worse than what was initially thought it would be. And look, to be honest, it's not the first time that Sally Pearson has had combinations of bad luck or controversy involving the Commonwealth Games, involving her career. If we hark back to Melbourne in 2006, she was in the hurdles final and she tripped, and that cost her any chance of a medal. We go to the 2010 Commonwealth Games in Delhi, and she was in the 100-metre sprint, so the flat sprint, in addition to the hurdles. And in the 100 metres, she had a false start, but was allowed to line up for a restart, and eventually she got through. But there was a protest on that, and then, yeah, it was absolutely controversial. And then just a few nights later, she went on to win the 100 metres hurdles final. So it has surrounded her. But, of course, you know, she's had a great career and she won the Olympic gold medal in London in 2012 in the 100-metre hurdles. And at that stage, she was heading into the hurdles at final at London. I think she'd won 32 from 34 starts. So she was in the form of her life. And she's regained that form recently as last year's World Championships when she won the gold medal again in London. So, look, she's had a great career, but it has been marred by some injuries and a touch of controversy. And, look, you could just add her bad luck as well in the Commonwealth Games.
And given that form, though, that you've mentioned in recent times, surely this doesn't mark the end of her career?
Well, I don't know whether, I obviously can't say for sure whether she will continue on, but she is 31 years of age, which for an athlete that's getting towards the end of their career, it has been a great career. She's a two-time world champion. As I said, she's the 2012 Olympic champion. She has represented Australia with absolute dignity, but yeah, she is coming to the end of her career. And I know she was really, obviously she's a Gold Coast resident, she was really keen to perform in front of her home crowd at these Commonwealth Games, and she'll be no doubt devastated that she, if she has to indeed pull out.
And her event is, of course, the 100-metre hurdles. What does this mean for Australia's medal chances in that event?
Well, look, the bottom line is Sally Pearson was our one athlete who could win the 100-metre hurdles, I think. I don't think there's another one who's really going to challenge for the gold medal or indeed for the medals. Our hopes were on Sally Pearson, so that's one event. Of course, we'll win plenty of gold medals. I think it was 49 was the count at the last games in Glasgow. So there are obviously going to be plenty of golds for Australia, but I don't think there'll be any gold for Sally Pearson.
ABC reporter Neil Cross on the Gold Coast covering the Commonwealth Games. What changes to a person's mental and physical health occur when they work for the Australian Defence Force? Well, for the first time, a comprehensive study is examining the impact of military service on personnel during and after their time in the ADF. And the first stage of research has been released. It's found the number of former defence personnel with a mental health disorder is a matter of concern that warrants attention. Our reporter Stephanie Boris is following the story. Stephanie, good afternoon. What was the motivation behind this report?
Well, today's reports form part of the largest study ever undertaken in Australia, which is looking at what impact military service has on people and how they transition from the Defence Force back to civilian life. About 5,000 men and women leave the ADF every year, some altogether and others move into the reserves. And as you're aware, a light has been shone on the number of former defence members struggling with life outside the force. But there's little research and figures in terms of how many people this impact. So these studies put concrete detail behind the personal stories that we've been hearing, and the first stages of the research have been released. The government's hoping by collaborating these facts and figures about the health of current and former Defence Force personnel that it will help them improve the policies and procedures in place, because there has been great criticism around what the government is able to do in order to help these people.
Right, so what do the reports tell us?
A number of facts in here, and some of them are quite astonishing. Nearly half of all personnel that leave the ADF suffer from a mental health disorder within the first 5 years, and the report says that is a matter of concern that warrants attention. There is some encouraging news, though, Thomas. 84% of former ADF members are working or engaged in some sort of so-called purposeful activity, so a high level of social engagement. As to how many seek help, though, this is interesting. Most took the initial steps to get assistance, but then many didn't follow through with the treatment. And comparing former ADF members to the general community actually drank more standard drinks at social events compared to former ADF members, but the levels of psychological distress were about three times higher among ADF personnel compared to the general Australian community.
So what do the studies identify as areas of improvement?
Yeah, so the studies acknowledge that there are programs in place already by the federal government and by charities that do help former Australian Defence Force personnel, but they need a bit more time to provide further impact and greater encouragement for these people. Of course, so more work is needed in this space, and that is something the government is aware of. It says this research confirms it's heading in the right direction, but more needs to be done. So as to what needs to be done, a better integration and coordination of services and the effectiveness of treatment. The report was saying that there are doctors out there that are wonderful in this mental health space but need more training when it comes to former military personnel. And also, in general, the stigma that's attached to mental health. That's not just within the ADF but also in the wider community. And changing that course of conversation and our interpretations of mental health across Australia in general, so people don't feel afraid or ashamed to seek help.
Stephanie Boris reporting there. Australia's Information Commissioner and Acting Privacy Commissioner has announced a formal investigation into Facebook, following confirmation from the company that the information of more than 300,000 Australian users might have been acquired and used without authorisation. And today we've been told that the political consulting firm Cambridge Analytica might have had access to the data of 87 million Facebook users around the world. That's 37 million more than initial estimates. Facebook revealed the number in a blog post, and the company says it's making changes to limit the ways third parties can get a hold of data. Well, to discuss the latest, I spoke to cybersecurity and privacy journalist Stilgherrian, and he says even this latest number might not be correct.
It could easily be much more for two reasons. One is that it's obvious that Facebook doesn't keep track of these numbers itself. And the other one is that's only one way that Cambridge Analytica could have got data on Facebook users. We don't know whether there are any more pathways for that data to have got to CA. And in a sense, pretty much every marketing company that plugs into Facebook does that. You put an app that runs on the Facebook platform up, people start using it, and that app can harvest those people's social graph, as it's called. I mean, this is kind of Facebook's business model.
Now, this number of people affected, it was revealed in a blog post, and specifically towards the end of that post. In your view, was that a deliberate move?
Of course it was. Facebook wants to downplay this. Facebook definitely wants to make this seem like a one-off. Now, the only reason Facebook cares about this now is that their share price is down 15%, still falling.
Do you think that Facebook's done the right thing, though, by coming clear that the number of people involved was much worse than expected?
Have they come clear, though? I mean, we've got two numbers now. This is what amuses me, is that will we see a third number? And do they really know?
So let's chat Australia. From an Australian perspective, we've learnt that more than 300,000 people here may have had their information exposed. Can you tell me more about the value of that sort of data?
There is an entire marketplace in personal data, data harvested from one application, from one social media network, is combined with data from elsewhere by companies that are really just called data brokers. They gather this information, cross-match it, and use it to compile dossiers on us. And that becomes a mechanism for two things. One, it can be used to target advertising quite specifically at us. And the concern is when you combine that with the psychological profiling that Cambridge Analytica claims to be able to do, you can target those ads in a way that are much more likely to persuade you. The other possibility really is that this information can be used in ways to discriminate against us. In the United States, for example, there are companies that do employment screenings so that if you apply for a job with a company, a third-party organisation will use the data they have to advise whether that employee could be high risk, which means that the employer has plausible deniability. They were just told this person's a high risk and they don't know why.
Now, the ability to use email addresses and phone numbers to harvest data has been questioned during this scandal. What's the danger of being able to do that?
If you know someone's email address or phone number, you can cross-match that very, very easily with everything they've ever done anywhere using that email address or phone number. And it's very difficult for us to change that. We tend to keep email addresses and phone numbers for a long time. The difficulty here, I think, is lack of transparency. We don't know what these companies are doing. And even if we did know, we don't really have an understanding of how powerful this data is because the researchers themselves don't understand how powerful the data is. This particular controversy involving Facebook is starting to shape up as the one which may trigger a real change in government policies and regulation. But we'll see.
Cybersecurity and privacy journalist Stilgherrian. There's concern Australia could stand to lose if trade tensions between China and the United States escalate into a full-blown trade war. In the latest development, Beijing has announced a new range of tariffs on American imports, including aircraft, soybeans and other food products. And that was in response to US President Donald Trump's move to place tariffs on Chinese high-tech goods. Well, Professor James Lawrenson is the Deputy Director of the Australia-China Relations Institute at the University of Technology, Sydney. He spoke to our reporter, Jonathan Hare.
Well, it's a $50 billion escalation. Trump said that he would put in place tariffs on $50 billion worth of Chinese imported goods, and China, a few hours later, said it would respond with tariffs on $50 billion worth of US imports.
Are some of these items that they've decided to hit with this tariff, have they decided on those items for a reason? Is it to send a message to the US or hurt them in some way?
Oh, it's a clear message. Aircraft, for example, is a huge export earner for the US. My understanding is 25% of Boeing sales go to China. So if you take out that market, or if you make that market more difficult to access, then that's going to clearly put a lot of pressure on Trump.
What happens from here? Does it continue to escalate?
Yeah, my sense is that China will not want to be looked to be backing down. So if in 2 months' time, Trump goes ahead and puts in place these tariffs, bang, straight away China will respond with what it's said it would do today. Where it goes from there is anyone's guess. But the big worry in all of this, of course, is that Trump's trade policies are taking place outside the WTO. This rules-based order that we like talking about in Australia, it's not working too well at the moment.
Is there all that much the WTO can actually do about this?
Well, it can do quite a lot if countries are willing to take their actions through the WTO. That's the problem. The US can protest about China's trade policy through the WTO. But Trump hasn't taken that route. He's using domestic legislation to enact these more protectionist trade policies. So Trump has taken the WTO out of the picture.
President Trump says this isn't a trade war, is it?
Well, a trade war is when you throw a punch and someone throws a punch back. That's exactly what we've seen happening. Look, don't get me wrong. I think China will be keen to negotiate with Trump, and I don't think Trump really wants a trade war either, but you've thrown the first punch. So that's a definition of how a trade war starts.
Is this maybe part of President Trump's negotiation style? Is he simply bluffing because China might have more to lose in this?
Personally, I've got my doubts. At some point, I think you do have to take Trump seriously. And as I said, he's been very consistent on trade. So, well, if it's a negotiating style, I'd say it's not working very well because the Chinese are playing it very well. It's hard to guess what the end result will be, but I'm pretty confident that there will be some sort of negotiated settlement. Let's hope there is, because frankly, from Australia's perspective, our two major trading partners engaged in a war with each other is clearly a negative for us.
What kind of impacts can we expect this to have on Australia?
Yeah, this is a direct one, which of course is that some of our iron ore exports to China end up in manufactured goods sold to the US. So if the US is buying less Chinese manufactured goods, that means less of our China needs, less of our iron ore. But the big impact is actually an indirect one. We're a small open economy. We really rely on a rules-based trading system. If that starts to unravel, which it is at the moment, then we're in real trouble.
The Deputy Director of the Australia-China Relations Institute, Professor James Lawrenson. He was speaking to our reporter, Jonathan Hare. This is The World Today. If you ever miss a program, you can find us on the ABC Listen app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. You can also follow us on Facebook and on Twitter at ABC News. And you can follow me at Thomas Ariti. Australian medical researchers say they're a step closer to a world where some leukemia patients might not have to go through chemotherapy for treatment. Experts from the Royal Melbourne Hospital and the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre have published the results of two trials, and they've found a combination of drugs was more successful than conventional treatments in certain cases. Connie Aegis filed this report.
Chris Travatus' life was turned upside down when he was diagnosed with leukaemia. Chemotherapy and a stem cell transplant initially worked, but then he relapsed.
I could have done chemotherapy again and gone through the whole process, but it would not have been successful.
He decided to take part in one of two medical trials of a tablet called venetoclax. He's now in remission. Professor John Seymour from the Peter MacCallum Cancer Centre led one of those studies.
One of these was in the setting of a form of leukaemia called chronic lymphocytic leukaemia that had recurred despite prior chemotherapy.
Venetoclax was developed in Melbourne to treat chronic lymphocytic leukaemia. It's the most common form of leukaemia in Australia, with 1,000 people diagnosed every year. Venetoclax was combined with another drug for a study involving 389 patients with this type of cancer. Professor John Seymour says the results were promising for those who'd relapsed or were resistant to more conventional treatment.
The venetoclax combination was profoundly superior to the previous chemotherapy, more than doubling the likelihood of patients remaining well with their leukemia under control at 2 years, and a very high rate of clearance of all detectable leukemia from the blood, and a halving of the risk of death from their leukemia. So this clearly shows that the venetoclax combination is profoundly superior to chemotherapy and really should replace the use of chemotherapy in that setting.
Professor Seymour says chemotherapy shouldn't be disregarded completely.
There are varying forms of chemotherapy, and in many circumstances it remains the recommended and optimal use for some forms of cancers.
The second medical trial targeted mantle cell lymphoma, an uncommon subtype of lymphoma which is considered incurable in most patients. The research team combined venetoclax with another drug.
That combination was shown to be much more effective than we would have predicted using either drug alone, with more than 70% of patients having no detectable lymphoma using these two pills together.
Professor Seymour says the data has been submitted to regulatory authorities around the world and the results have been published in the New England Journal of Medicine.
Connie Agius. Perhaps it's no surprise that the traditional idea of men being the breadwinner in many Australian families is changing, but perhaps not as much as you might think. According to new data, there's been a small increase in the number of stay-at-home dads here, but it's still not common, and researchers say there are many reasons why, including persisting gender stereotypes and more families having both parents in work. Sarah Sedgi with this report.
Father of two, Rhys Allen enjoys being able to spend so much time with his young children. He took some time off work to care for his first child and made the decision to become a stay-at-home father after his second child was born.
If it's just convention and tradition that are stopping you, then absolutely consider it, because it's the best experience I think a guy can have. Very rare, very privileged to be able to have the little kids around and watch them grow. I think, you know, so many guys miss out on that part of the kids' lives.
According to census data analysed by the Australian Institute of Family Studies, he's one of about 80,000 Australian men who are stay-at-home fathers. The 2016 data reflects a slight increase in the number of stay-at-home dads compared to 2011, when that figure was 68,500. But it's not a common scenario for many Australian families. And Jennifer Baxter, a senior research fellow at the Australian Institute of Family Studies, says there are many reasons why.
We still do have very strong gender stereotypes around caring that no doubt do make it difficult for some dads.
She also says more families now have both parents in work and that these families need flexibility to help juggle their work and caring responsibilities.
When we look at research on mums, we know that, you know, mums get a lot out of work, not just the income, that sort of there's a lot of enjoyment and status and stimulation from work, and you know, dads are the same. And so we don't necessarily expect to see massive increases in dads taking, you know, a really long time out of work to care for children. I think what's more likely is that, you know, well, what we would, I guess, wish to see is to see dads taking up more flexible work arrangements, reducing their hours a bit.
Professor Ray Cooper is the co-director of the Women Work and Leadership Research Group at the University of Sydney's Business School. She also believes that gender stereotypes persist and can prevent some men from spending more time at home.
Whilst we're having some changes in the workforce around the expectations of what we can access in terms of flexibility, unfortunately, things are still moving very, very slowly and are not catching up with our attitudes and our hopes and dreams about what we can access at work. So I think that what we're seeing here in these data is slower movement than we'd like to see in organisations around their policies and their practices about accessing flexibility. And I think critically, it's about who can access flexibility. We still see some really strong barriers to men being able to access flexible working arrangements. And I think this is one of the reasons that's behind this quite slow movement in the uptake in, you know, stay-at-home dads.
Professor Ray Cooper from the University of Sydney, and Sarah Sedgi was our reporter. That's all from the World Today team for this Thursday. Don't forget, Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening, and we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. I'm Thomas Arete. Have a lovely afternoon.